for me, it was just a day of resolve and resolution. And I said, I'm sign me up.
Well, the first thing is, you know, I told them that I went to jail. And their first reaction was like, ooh, grandmama. You know, I was like, well, let me explain.
It was just, you knew that God was on your side. And we knew that it didn't matter what we were facing. God's on your side. You'll overcome it.
James Stewart, Eloise Gaffney, and Washington Booker are all in their early 60s. They're all from Birmingham. They're all African American. And 50 years ago, they made national news.
American Airlines presents Douglas Edwards with the late news.
In Birmingham, Alabama, the civil rights demonstrators became wholesale today, and police arrested more than 450 Negro schoolchildren who played hooky to parade and picket and pray.
On May 2nd, 1963, Stewart, Gaffney, and Booker were among the teenagers who took part in what became known as the Children's March. It was a protest against racial segregation in Birmingham. If you ever saw the black and white film footage of Negro protesters being met with fire hoses and police dogs, that's it.
Police loaded some of the school children onto school buses, arresting, among others, a 6-year-old girl. The Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth says the demonstrations will continue until we run out of children.
I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
It was mean, and we lived through it.
Eloise Gaffney.
And when I tell my kids, they still don't. My children find it hard to believe. And my grandchildren, it's really far-fetched, you know. When I say I couldn't go to Fair Park, and, I mean, you had to pass by Fair Park and see the kids out there playing. So naturally, the child's like, why I can't go over there, you know. And I'm sure parents then had a hard time answering those kinds of questions.
On May 2nd, 1963, Gaffney would take part in the Children's March. James Stewart did too.
My mother, when I was very young, my mother took me to town and into one of the stores. And there, I had found out by this time that the tall, rectangular water fountains had cold water. And the ones right next to it, which were the porcelain white basin type fountains, had warm water. So there was a stool in front of the tall one. So I got up on the stool, and I was about to get the water, drink of cold water, and my mother just came out of nowhere saying, no! And she lunged at me and swept me away, and she started talking to me about what I could and couldn't do. And those rules were hard to comprehend, because you had to know what's right and what's wrong and what's white.
Gaffney and Stewart would be joined during the Children's March by Washington Booker.
I can remember seeing, I don't know, some kid with a banana split, a white kid sitting at the counter, a big old banana split. And, I mean, I don't know. I had nothing to compare it to and how it looked. It was just a marvelous thing, and I wanted one. I wanted to sit there at that counter and eat one. And I always thought about that during the marches when we demonstrated. I would think about that, I want to be able to sit at that lunch counter. Yeah, so I can order me one of them banana splits. It seems trivial, but it was a part of the way you understood the world.
Birmingham area teenagers who took part in the 1963 Children's March say local disc jockey Shelley the Playboy signaled the start of the protest, but he didn't organize it. The credit for that goes to a lieutenant of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the Reverend James Bevel. One of the students he inspired was James Stewart.
He wore one of the blue jean suits with badges from everybody and all over the little pins all over him. And he was bald headed and he wore a little skull cap. And he's the one who was kind of the kids' Pied Piper. And he talked to us about getting involved. So it was accumulation of things. And we just reached a point where we said, you know, we don't care. We've got to do something to change this.
And that's where Birmingham area disc jockey Shelley the Playboy Stewart comes in. James Bevel also wanted to use local radio stations to get the word out on protest day. He spoke with Shelley as well as another local disc jockey named Paul White. His radio audience knew him as Tall Paul. Shelley says on May 2, 1963, he and Tall Paul announced the beginning of the Children's March. They just did it in a roundabout way. They used codes.
You had to have codes to get into the community. We said, made an announcement, I want everybody to go to the park. I mean, you don't do that. Because remember, there were mothers and fathers who were afraid, would lock the doors, and the principals and teachers would lock the doors. So you just went around that. There's, as we say years ago, there's more ways than one to skin a cat. Shake, rattle, and roll. That's an old tune by an artist called Joe Turner. And we say when we play shake, rattle, and roll, that's the signal. Time to go out. So shake, rattle, and roll.
Get out of that bed. Wash your face and hands. Get out of that bed. Wash your face and hands. Well, you get in that kitchen, make some noise with the pots and pans.
And when those kids heard that, they told the teachers, we gone. And the teachers tried to stop them. They were jumping out of windows at Parker High School. They were jumping. So that is really what took place. Yes, and it could escalate it, and the police didn't know what to do about it.
I believe till my soul you a devil in nine.
Jail was like hell. It was 4 days of really hell.
James Stewart of Birmingham was just a teenager on May 2, 1963. He took part in what became known as the Children's March, and he was one of the first to be arrested and jailed.
We were put in a room probably that could hold 50, 60 people. They put maybe 300 people in that room. There was standing room only. It was a concrete floor, concrete walls, very small windows with the bars on them, and it was extremely hot. And they just kept putting us in that room. We had to develop a system to even sleep. We would make space on the floor, and most of us would stand around the wall or sit in the windows, and those slept on the floor slept on the concrete.
Washington Booker was in that cell, too.
It, going to jail didn't, nobody slowed down, broke nobody's spirit. You know, okay, now, we in jail. This is what we're supposed to be. This is what we're supposed to be doing. Come on, y'all, let's sing. You ain't going to let nobody turn me around. And we go through, we sang. So it was anything but punishment.
That was on day one of the Children's March. On day two, more protests took place, more arrests were made, but when these students were put behind bars, Booker and Stewart noticed they were soaking wet.
So I was out in the park when they released the fire hoses and the dogs.
Eloise Gaffney.
I was walking along. At that time, it was Fifth Avenue, and it was a whole row of businesses there, and they had glass windows. And, I mean, the water was so forceful that it knocked me into the window. I mean, they were in the park, and this water had come, like, over a block. But guess what? We found fun in it. Some of us just would, you know, lay on the ground and just let the water just push you all across the park. You know, we made a fun thing out of it. You know, of course, some girls, I know one of the girls that were actually bitten by the dogs. So that part was really scary, but the fear just really didn't come. Now when I think about it, I was like, Lord, it had to be the Lord to keep us because we were so crazy we didn't realize the danger.
September 15th, 1963 started off just like any other Sunday for Barbara Cross, with morning Sunday school class down in the basement of 16th Street Baptist Church. Cross remembers that day's Sunday school lesson.
And our Sunday school lesson that day was a love that forgives. I'll never forget that as long as I live. In my class particular, we discuss the scripture from Matthew, the fifth chapter, about talking about agape love, the godly type of love, and agape is the Greek word for godly love.
It was the first time Pastor John Cross, Barbara's father, initiated Youth Sunday under his ministry. After class, the children were getting ready for their other responsibilities that Sunday.
I remember a good friend of mine came by the classroom, and we were going to go to the bathroom together. And my teacher stopped me. My teacher's name was Mrs. DeMann. And she gave me an assignment that literally spared my life and kept me out of harm's way.
Cross was asked to write the names of those who would be moving up to the next age level in Sunday school. It was just a few minutes later that Sunday would soon be marred by an explosion that would change Birmingham forever.
And I remembered I was in the process of writing the names down. The most horrific noise that I had ever heard in my life. I remember the building shaking. I remembered hearing children screaming.
Four young girls died, many more injured, and the community ripped apart by an act of violence on what was supposed to be a peaceful Sunday.
50 years ago, a bomb exploded at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. Four young girls were killed in the blast. It would take 14 years before the first Klansman was tried and convicted in the bombing. Robert Chambliss was found guilty of his part in the attack. He wound up here at the St. Clair County Correctional Facility, about 40 miles northeast of Birmingham. It's here where Chambliss wrote letters to his family during his time in prison. The handwritten letters and the pictures they paint from that time can now be found with just a short ride down a creaky elevator to the bowels of the Archives Department at the Birmingham Public Library.
April 20, 1979. Yes, Mommy, you told me you called the governor. Mommy, I ask you again, did you talk to the governor? Did you call my lawyer? What did he say?
Mommy is Chambliss's wife in a letter read by library archivist Jim Baggett.
Wrote the governor a nice 2.5-page letter. The reason, he sent the lieutenant governor's staff over here to talk to me. Tell our little Bobby to write one. Put in your letter so it won't cost her postage. Answer soon, your loving husband. R.E. Chambliss.
Baggett has been studying those decade-old letters in detail.
Chambliss is almost entirely focused on himself in his letters. There's a lot of self-pity, and, you know, he presents himself as a victim. And he never acknowledges involvement in the bombings. But, no, there's no remorse. There's no acceptance of responsibility at all.
Let's put you in the position of being a black person living in the South during the Civil Rights Movement.
If you picked up a white newspaper, you as a black person did not exist.
Craig Flournoy is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a professor of journalism at Southern Methodist University.
There was no record of you being born, no record of you graduating from high school, much less college, no record of you getting married, no record of your promotion, and no record of you dying.
In other words, unless you were famous like Joe Louis or Louis Armstrong, a black person might not make it into most white newspapers unless they committed a crime. So when it came to coverage of events surrounding the Civil Rights Movement, there was little, if any, coverage at all. Take the Montgomery bus boycott as an example.
The New York Times basically missed the story.
Again, Craig Flournoy.
They relied on wire service copy for the first 4 months, and the esteemed Johnny Popham, the greatest reporter covering the South during this time, wrote exactly two stories about it.
Hi. Hi. Where are y'all from?
Oregon. That's like a long way off.
Yeah, it's a long way off.
Betty and Phil Histon are from Corvallis, Oregon. They're in Alabama like many tourists, to try the local barbecue and to see the sights. However, today's trip has nothing to do with the music scene in Muscle Shoals or the Alabama football coach Bear Bryant in Tuscaloosa. The Histons are at the Civil Rights Interpretive Center in Selma.
We have heard about the Civil Rights Movement since we were children. I wanted to see where some of these things had taken place. It's part of the history that we wanted to see, be part of.
We were on a cross-country trip, and we knew the name Selma, and things happened here, and so we kind of wanted to see where it really happened.
And the Histons are not alone. If you want to see how big civil rights tourism is in Alabama, state tourism officials say look no farther than the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham. The center attracts an estimated 150,000 visitors a year. Lee Sintel is the tourism director for the state of Alabama. He says the business is big enough for three cities to fight over.
There is no agreement in this state as to which city owns the civil rights movement. because people in Montgomery think that everything happened in the Montgomery area. People in Birmingham think that the major events only took place in Birmingham. So Birmingham, Montgomery, and Selma are three cities where more tourists visit because that's where the landmarks are.
Those were the only black students there at the school. And they began as soon as the integration started at 54 and 55.
But sitting in her living room in Georgia, just a few minutes outside of Atlanta, Fannie Motley points to old photographs of the first nine black students admitted to Spring Hill College. Her picture is on the top. Motley says she was hesitant to attend Spring Hill at first, but her husband insisted.
He said, now that the integration law has passed, and since Spring Hill has opened up its doors, and we're right here, said, all you have to do to finish your last 2 years of college, just get in the car and ride out that Spring Hill every day.
Motley wasn't your typical college student. She was 29, married, and had two young sons when she transferred to Spring Hill in 1955. That was just a few months after the Jesuit University decided to integrate. In 1955,
they would ask questions on the literacy test, some so outrageous as, tell the number of jelly beans in this jar.
Congress passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965. The measure made it illegal to ask voters to pass any test before casting a ballot. Now, almost 50 years later, Shelby County in Alabama is challenging the constitutionality of one part of the act. Cam Ward is a state senator representing District 14, which includes Shelby County. He says the issue is over something called preclearance.
Anytime we want to annex someone into our cities, we have to get permission from the Justice Department. Anytime we want to de-annex, change our city lines, we have to get permission from the Justice Department. And that seems extremely overburdensome for one area of the country to have to do it as opposed to another.
Ward thinks the Voting Rights Act has served a valuable purpose and continues to do so. But when it comes to the preclearance provision, changes need to be made. He's a supporter of efforts to challenge the act before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Used to be a sundry store right here on the corner to your right there, where this building is.
Hobson City could be easy to miss if you're just passing through. About 2 miles long, the town sits between Anniston and Oxford. The city was once a part of Oxford until an African-American justice of the peace was elected from the area. Oxford's mayor redrew the boundaries and kicked out Hobson City. The town was incorporated in 1899 as Alabama's first all-black city.
Nobody thought that it would work because blacks were not used to governing themselves.
Hobson City Mayor Alberta McCrory.
In fact, some of the newspapers referred to it as maybe a project or a test of some kind, and they would wait to see what happened. So here we are, still existing here in Hobson City in 2013.
There's a cross that's not yet burned, but it's placed about where those recycling bins are that really welcome her when the car stops here at the intersection.
Next Tuesday marks 50 years since the stand in the schoolhouse door. That's when Governor George Wallace tried to keep two African-American students from enrolling at the Tuscaloosa campus in 1963. The names of Vivian Malone and James Hood are etched in civil rights history, but they weren't the first.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So things were said to her, things were thrown at her. But think about your day-to-day. What do you do on a daily basis? You walk to classes, right?
He's referring to Authorine Lucy. She enrolled in Tuscaloosa in 1956, 7 years before Malone and Hood. Black says the reception wasn't welcoming.
One of the images there on the next page over, you'll see, is a group of pro-segregationist folks. They're burning in effigy a copy of the Brown v. Board decision.
Lucy lasted 3 days before leaving the campus.
If you've ever been to a high school reunion, they can be a little nerve-wracking. But tonight's gathering at the Tuskegee Human and Civil Rights Multicultural Center has a different vibe. For the former students here, all in their 60s now, it's not so much a reunion as it is a reflection. They're looking back on what was supposed to be the first day of classes on September 2nd, 1963. Former student Willie Wyatt Jr. was one of the 13 black students integrating Tuskegee High School.
I thought, well, okay, there's going to be 300 to 400 other kids in the school. How am I going to make friends? How am I going to be accepted? Is there anything that's going to happen that it's going to cause me to react and respond. So that was kind of the thought running through my head.
But Wyatt never made it to the first day of class. No one did. That's because Alabama Governor George Wallace intervened to stop the school from desegregating. Wyatt vividly remembers what happened that morning.
The school was surrounded by state troopers, and the 13 of us who boarded the bus got to the driveway of the school, and Captain Pryor of the Alabama State Patrol got on the bus and gave us all a copy of an executive order from the governor denying us admission to the school.